between the task force and our partner organizations, the CIA, FBI, NSA, and conventional military units with whom we had to coordinate operations. Initially, representatives from these organizations lived in separate trailers with limited access to our compound. Built in the name of security, these physical walls prevented routine interaction and produced misinformation and mistrust. The NSA, for instance, initially refused to provide us with raw signal intercepts, insisting that they had to process their intelligence and send us summaries, often a process of several days. They weren't being intentionally difficult. Their internal doctrine held that only they could effectively interpret their collections. Passing out raw data invited misinterpretation, with potentially disastrous consequences. But exquisitely accurate analyses of where the enemy had been 3 days earlier wouldn't enable us to intercept foreign fighters bent on suicide attacks. Until we fixed the blinks, we would not be fully effective. We needed operational teams to gather, organize, and relay data to analysts in Baghdad, Tampa, and Washington. These analysts would then need to examine the data and communicate conclusions to the original team for follow-on action. Simultaneously, we needed to disseminate the relevant takeaways to the thousands of people in our organization, and we needed administrative higher-ups to modify operations and allocate resources based on the analysis. All this would have to take place in the span of hours, not weeks, and each situation would be different from those that came before. We had to find a way for the organization as a whole to build, at scale, the same messy connectivity our small teams had mastered so effectively. Our circumstances were unique, but the problem is not. Though teams have proliferated across organizations from hospitals to airline crews, almost without exception this has happened within the confines of broader reductionist structures, and this has limited their adaptive potential. In treating victims of the Boston bombing, Brigham and Women's salvaged, as opposed to amputating, a much higher percentage of limbs than other hospitals, despite having equal or higher average levels of injury of incoming patients. In a paper written with their colleagues after the bombing, Doctors Carty and Caterson credited their hospital's culture of fostering preparation and teamwork through daily collaborative interactions. The medical staff had long-standing relationships built over years in caring for routine patients. Thus, when crisis struck, no decision was made in a vacuum, says Caterson, meaning that there was no longer a single surgeon saying this lower extremity is mangled, I'm going to take this leg off. We would make decisions as a team. Yet even Brigham and Women's has admitted that the overall organization did not possess the ability to deal with such an unexpected event. Problems existed on the fault lines, in the spaces between elite teams. Different departments in the hospital had different conventions for keeping track of unknown patients. As an unprecedented volume of patients were whisked between the ER, operating theaters, and burn units, the tracking system was overtaxed. A report noted that a nurse or technician manually moved each patient's icon on a tracking board so other staff members could find them. In the post-bombing chaos, the staff did not always move tiles in a timely manner, so they did not always know exactly where patients were located. Brigham and Women's accomplished tremendous things that day, but the larger an enterprise gets, the harder it is for it to think and act as one. In a now-famous 1999 Institute of Medicine study, To Err is Human, it was estimated that between 44,000 and 98,000 people died every year as a result of medical errors. Even if the lower estimate of the study is used, deaths due to medical errors would have been the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's seventh leading cause of death in 1998, meaning that more people died as a result of medical errors than from motor vehicle accidents, 43,458 deaths. Breast cancer, 42,297 deaths. Or AIDS, 16,516 deaths. CDC rankings don't include medical error as a separate cause category of death. A new study published in September 2013 asserts that the number of deaths due to medical error is dramatically higher. 210,000 to 400,000. Either estimate would have put medical errors as the third leading cause of death in the CDC's 2011 ranking. If the estimated 100,000 deaths due to hospital-acquired infections are included, this loss is equal to 20 Boeing 747 airliners going down every week. Command of teams. The quandary faced by Brigham and Women's in 2013, like that faced by our task force in 2004, was that of what we might call a command of teams. Adaptive small teams operating within an old-fashioned rigid superstructure. In a response to rising tactical complexity, many organizations in many domains have replaced small commands with teams. But the vast majority of these organizations have to be much larger than a single team. They consist of multiple teams, and these teams are wired together just like a traditional command. This stifles the team's adaptive potential. When confined to silos like those of our task force, teams might achieve tactical adaptability, but will never be able to exhibit those traits at a strategic level. The proliferation of the command of teams is not unique to mission-critical endeavors. A study of some 700 manufacturers by MIT economist Paul Osterman found that most were using work teams, and that almost half had the majority of their employees working in teams. A survey by the Work in America Institute of 100 leading companies found that 95% of respondents ranked teamwork, creating and sustaining team-based organizations, as the research topic that would have the greatest value for their organizations. Of course, office teams may be cohesive and adaptable, or they may be teams in name only, the result of a manager putting up some posters, giving a pep talk, and then retreating to his corner office. Teams, like many of the topics studied in this book, trust, purpose, the need for adaptability, etc., can easily devolve into a bumper sticker solution, rhetoric parading as real transformation. Nonetheless, studies at large companies with robust data sets, such as Xerox, Ford, and P&G, have found that the implementation of teams often leads to leaps in productivity as well as improvements in morale. Teams can bring a measure of adaptability to previously rigid organizations, but these performance improvements have a ceiling as long as adaptable traits are limited to the team level. As the world grows faster and more interdependent, we need to figure out ways to scale the fluidity of teams across entire organizations, groups with thousands of members that span continents, like our task force. But this is easier said than done. Small teams are effective in large part because they are small. People know each other intimately and have clocked hundreds of hours with each other. In large organizations, most people will inevitably be strangers to one another. In fact, the very traits that make teams great can often work to prevent their coherence into a broader whole. How does one build a team with 7,000 swim buddies? The point at which everyone else sucks. Anybody who has taken an introductory microeconomics course has learned of diminishing marginal returns. With most goods and services, each additional unit brings less value or gratification than the one before. A sandwich will bring a very hungry man great satisfaction, The second sandwich will bring some happiness, the third a little less, and the tenth will probably be difficult to eat and might make you sick. As it relates to manpower, this is known as the problem of too many cooks in the kitchen. There is a difference between diminishing marginal returns, when each additional unit adds less value than the previous one, this probably sets in after the first sandwich, and diminishing total returns, when each additional unit adds negative value, the sandwich that makes you feel worse than before eating it. For our purposes, the difference is not important. The point is that the positive attributes of labor do not always increase with scale. How many cooks is too many? It depends. In a small kitchen or office, 4 might be the ideal number. For a company with operations the size of Walmart, the breakpoint is much higher. For some activities, like having an engaging conversation, diminishing marginal returns sets in after a few people. For other tasks, like producing a mechanical item via assembly line, you can add just as much value with the 100th employee as with the first. For teams, this range is considerably narrower. Athletic teams, for instance, usually consist of 15 to 30 people. Army Ranger platoons are composed of 42 soldiers. SEAL squads contain between 16 and 20 people. Beyond such numbers, teams begin to lose the oneness that makes them adaptable. As the proverbial kitchen fills up, communication and trust break down, egos come into conflict, and the chemistry that fueled innovation and agility becomes destructive. In many cases, this loss of adaptability dooms the enterprise. Though any given SEAL was, like the entirety of our task force, on paper fighting the same fight, he was really fighting for his squad. The men on a squad prepare, deploy, and operate together. They spend 4-month rotations in the alien, hostile deserts of Iraq or the arid plains of Afghanistan, and they rarely have meaningful, friendly interaction with anyone outside this circle. Imagine the closest roommate relationship you've ever had, and multiply that by 100. The bonds within squads are fundamentally different from those between squads or other units. In the words of one of our SEALs, the squad is the point at which everyone else sucks. That other squadron sucks. The other SEAL teams suck. And our Army counterparts definitely suck. Of course, every other squad thought the same thing. Here we run up against a fundamental constraint in the empathetic bandwidth of the human mind. British anthropologist Robin Dunbar theorized that the number of people an individual can actually trust usually falls between 100 and 230. A more specific variant was popularized by Malcolm Gladwell as the rule of 150 in his book Outliers. This limitation leads to a kind of tribal competitiveness. Victory, as defined by the squad, the primary unit of allegiance, may not align with victory as defined by the task force. The goal becomes to accomplish missions better than the team that bunks on the other side of the base, rather than to win the war. In other words, the magic of teams is a double-edged sword. Once organizations get big, some of the same traits that make an adaptable team great can make it incompatible with the structure it serves. Thousands of fledgling businesses have sunk because of an inability to scale their teamwork. Joel Peterson, a professor at the Stanford School of Business, says the rigidity that sets in with scale is one of the main causes of startup failure. And the late J. Richard Hackman, a Harvard sociology professor, found that teams are much trickier to build and maintain than we like to think. The issue is not that teams never work, but that team dynamics are powerful but delicate, and expansion is a surefire way to break them. It's a fallacy that bigger teams are better than smaller ones because they have more resources to draw on, he explains. As a team gets bigger, the number of links that need to be managed among members goes up at an accelerating, almost exponential rate. In his handbook, Leading Teams, Hackman reminds us of Brooks' Law, the adage that adding staff to speed up a behind-schedule project has no better chance of working than would a scheme to produce a baby quickly by assigning 9 women to be pregnant for 1 month each. Adding manpower to a late software project makes it later. It was not possible to make the task force one big team. But we also could not stick with our command of teams compromise. Stacking our small teams in silos had made us unwieldy. At the same time, we couldn't simply remove the reductionist superstructure and leave each team to its own devices. We needed coordination across the enterprise. Somehow, we would have to scale trust and purpose without creating chaos. Team of Teams. Millennia-old behavioral patterns, the neurological constraints of the human brain, and the history of American special operations were against us as we tried to move beyond the point where everyone else sucks. We needed to spread the oneness and the accompanying adaptability that infused individual Ranger platoons, Army Special Forces units, or SEAL squads across a task force of thousands. As we sat in our makeshift command center in Balad, reading reports of AQI bombings, we realized that our goal was not the creation of one massive team. We needed to create a team of teams. It may sound like a kitschy semantic distinction, but it actually marked a critical structural difference that turned the aspiration of scaling the magic of the team into a realizable goal. On a single team, every individual needs to know every other individual in order to build trust. And they need to maintain comprehensive awareness at all times in order to maintain common purpose. Easy with a group of 25, doable with a group of 50, tricky above 100, and definitely impossible across a task force of 7,000. But on a team of teams, every individual does not have to have a relationship with every other individual. Instead, the relationships between the constituent teams need to resemble those between individuals on a given team. We needed the SEALs to trust Army Special Forces, and for them to trust the CIA, and for them all to be bound by a sense of common purpose, winning the war, rather than outperforming the other unit. And that could be effectively accomplished through representation. We didn't need every member of the task force to know everyone else. We just needed everyone to know someone on every team, so that when they thought about or had to work with the unit that bunked next door or their intelligence counterparts in D.C., they envisioned a friendly face rather than a competitive rival. We didn't need everybody to follow every single operation in real time, something just as impossible as building lifelong friendships with 7,000 people. We needed to enable a team operating in an interdependent environment to understand the butterfly effect ramifications of their work and make them aware of the other teams with whom they would have to cooperate in order to achieve strategic, not just tactical, success. Time pressure was intense, and the stakes kept getting higher. Almost. Throughout 2004, Iraq steadily and disturbingly unraveled. Fallujah fell. Under Zarqawi's shadow, the city became an insurgent stronghold. By June, jihadists policed the streets, shutting down hair salons and movie theaters, torturing and killing Iraqi policemen and spies. Foreign fighters streamed into Iraq at a rate that we estimated to be 100 to 150 each month. Each additional person, usually a suicide bomber or fanatically committed fighter, represented scores of civilian deaths to come. Fallujah became a staging area for increasingly sophisticated attacks, like the September 30th sewage plant bombing. By the end of the year, attacks on American forces averaged 87 per day, and the American death toll had passed 1,000. AQI's momentum continued into 2005, as Zarqawi orchestrated a campaign of violent intimidation against January's parliamentary elections. Only 3,775 people voted in all of Anbar province, about 2% of the population. Zarqawi's taunting claims that he regularly passed through American checkpoints with ease, combined with his mounting stature as an insurgent leader, further highlighted our apparent impotence. Stopping Zarqawi was an operational imperative for the task force, and for me, it felt like an obsession. In February 2005, we had an opportunity to target Zarqawi. It had been 14 months since we first confirmed his presence inside Iraq. A combination of intelligence sources confirmed that he was traveling in a sedan, and a Predator drone, 10,000 feet above the ground, spotted the vehicle moving across a lightly populated area west of Baghdad. A flurry of communications sparked across the task force as we mobilized strike forces for immediate movement and requested conventional units to prevent escape of his vehicle. As the Predator operator tracked the sedan, it moved into a cul-de-sac, stopped momentarily, and then drove out. The operator, to maintain surveillance, had to adjust the camera, and through sheer bad luck, missed Zarqawi jumping from the vehicle and moving away on foot. We captured his computer and carbine, but it was a bitter disappointment. The man with the $25 million bounty on his head had eluded us yet again. Although we knew that finding the man would not destroy his organization, especially given how resilient and decentralized AQI was, we also knew it was a strategic and symbolic victory that we needed. Every missed opportunity to capture or, if need be, kill AQI operatives, especially one as valuable as Zarqawi, would cost U.S. military or Iraqi civilian lives down the line. Since I had taken command at the helm of the task force, the situation in Iraq had only grown worse, and this showed no signs of relenting. That June, I was summoned to the White House to brief the President on the status of our efforts to capture or kill Zarqawi. Sitting between Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in the cramped confines of the Situation Room, I provided George W. Bush and his assembled national security team with an overview of our efforts to date and my genuine confidence that ultimately we would stop him. But the real question was whether it would be soon enough to prevent his setting all of Iraq aflame. By this point, I knew that defeating Zarqawi and his organization could not be accomplished by a traditional command, even a command composed of teams as capable as our own. We would have to match AQI's adaptability while preserving our traditional strengths, and this would necessitate an unprecedented transformation. It would require a true team of teams. Accomplishing this would involve a complete reversal of the conventional approach to information sharing, delineation of roles, decision-making authority, and leadership.
Recap. Although our task force's constituent teams exemplified adaptability, a command-like superstructure, constrain the organization at large. This command of teams approach was more flexible than a conventional command, but was still not adaptable enough to deal with the complexities of the 21st century and battle AQI. Although teams have proliferated across many sectors, they have almost always done so in the confines of broader commands. More and more organizations will need to overcome this hurdle and become more adaptable. Unfortunately, many of the traits that made our teams so good also made it incredibly difficult to scale those traits across our organization. We were also up against some fundamental constraints. Building a single team the size of our task force would be impossible. The solution we devised was a team of teams, an organization within which the relationships between constituent teams resembled those between individuals on a single team. Teams that had traditionally resided in separate silos would now have to become fused to one another via trust and purpose.
Part 3. Sharing. In January 2000, Khalid Al-Midhar obtained a visa to enter the United States. 2 days earlier, he had been the subject of a joint CIA-FBI meeting. A CIA analyst present knew that Midhar had connections to suspected terrorists, but as a CIA analyst, he was not authorized to answer FBI questions regarding CIA information. When, later that summer, the FBI grew suspicious of Midhar, internal divisions at the Bureau hampered efforts to locate him, and an interested criminal FBI agent assigned to the case of the USS Cole bombing was erroneously told that since he was not an intelligence FBI agent, he could not pursue Midhar. The following September, Midhar piloted American Airlines Flight 77 into the Pentagon. In July 2001, an FBI agent in Phoenix sent a memo to FBI headquarters suggesting the possibility of a coordinated effort by Osama bin Laden to send terrorists to flight school in the United States and noting the inordinate number of individuals of investigative interest who were enrolled in flight schools in Arizona. Though they were addressed on the memo, members of the FBI's Osama bin Laden unit did not read the memo until after September 11th. And with regard to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man masterminding the attacks, the pieces of the puzzle arrived in the spring and summer of 2001, but they were not put together. In April, the CIA learned that someone named Mukhtar was coordinating a plot against the United States. And later that spring, they learned that a known terrorist, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was actively recruiting operatives to travel from Afghanistan to the United States for an attack. In August, the CIA learned that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nickname was Mukhtar, but the chatter from April about a Mukhtar who was engineering an attack had cooled off. The U.S. intelligence system was blinking red, as the 9/11 Commission report would later put it. Systems, plural, would be a more accurate description, as these roadblocks to sharing prevented the kind of integration that could have averted the attacks. Nobody connected the dots. Chapter 7. Seeing the System. It was October, but by late morning the heat was shimmering off the Baghdad pavement. A 26-year-old intelligence analyst with a scruffy beard and a Columbia camping shirt squinted as he left the task force's screening facility. He was carrying 7 pages of paper, the printout of a PowerPoint analysis he had assembled, and the brief biography of an Iraqi car dealer turned AQI operative. Time was critical. The analyst had been tracking this target for several weeks, but he had only confirmed the man's role and identity the day before questioning. Signals intercepts indicated he had recently been active inside the Capitol. AQI was using lethal VBIEDs, vehicle-borne, improvised explosive devices, to kill civilians in neighborhoods across the city. Targeting this man was crucial to stopping the terror campaign. In a bunker 50 yards from the screening facility, the analyst presented his conclusions to colleagues seated around a table in the Situational Awareness Room, SAR. Based on this analysis, the one-time car dealer became a priority. Our targeting machine digested this new intelligence and added him to the list of individuals we were tracking. The man in question did not know it, but his life had become much more dangerous. Soon, analysts identified the man's dwelling and vehicle, as well as two associates with whom he spoke and met. Shortly after 9 p.m., on the fourth day, intelligence assets located him in a house in the Huria neighborhood. A Predator unmanned aerial vehicle was requested. Intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, ISR, assets were in high demand, and the team using the Predator did not want to hand it over. But after a few tense conversations, the vehicle was rotating in a gyre 17,000 feet above the target's house, providing constant, real-time, full-motion video of the site. The man had been found. The next stage of our F3EA assembly line, FIX, clicked into gear as the intel analysts passed the case to their operational counterparts and began work on their next target. Within minutes, an Army Special Forces assault team was assembled, briefed, and on the move. They traveled in a small convoy of South African-made armored vehicles designed for street warfare. These had been procured after the bitter experience of street combat in Mogadishu 11 years earlier. Famously, this episode was commemorated in the book and movie, Black Hawk Down. The operators were focused and calm. It was not their first rodeo, nor was it an exceptionally challenging operation. The men in the car had done this more or less every day throughout their deployment. The Predator's slowly rotating video feeds streamed down to their vehicles, and as the operators watched, they refined their plan to secure the immediate area around the house to prevent his escape, then enter the building. The basic outline was the same as ever. If he surrendered, he would be captured and interrogated. If he fought, he would die. The vehicles arrived on target. The AQI operative remained inside, oblivious. He had been fixed. Next came the finish. At the objective, the streets were quiet. Once, Iraqis wandered at night to enjoy the cool evening air. But these days, that was a rare sight. The operators posted vehicles at three corners and sent two of their number to a fourth. Dogs barked, as they always do, but the noise produced no discernible reaction from local residents. Cautiously, the operators approached a metal gate that controlled entry to the house's driveway and carport. They placed two expanding ladders against the courtyard wall. Soon, laser aiming lights mounted on M4 carbines were darting around the courtyard, ready to engage any resistance. The breach was not dramatic. There was no explosion or gunfire. Just some muffled rattles as bolt cutters provided entry for operators who quickly followed, secured the courtyard, and approached the house. A few minutes later, the car dealer, come aspiring terrorist, appeared in the doorway, flex-cuffed and blindfolded. He had been finished. Next came exploitation. An operator accompanied by an interpreter led the man to one of the armored vehicles while a rapid search of his home gathered a computer, a phone, and some documents. In half an hour, he was at the unit's base, a now run-down Saddam Hussein-era villa. The operators, like the analysts, had performed superbly. They had delivered the honed efficiency that had, over the years, earned them their reputation as the world's finest. The team now handed the detainee and materials over to interrogators and intelligence experts who would analyze the man and the data. Like the intel team before them, the operators now moved on to the next target passed to them by the task force's assembly line. Whether or not the car dealer yielded intelligence of value was no longer the soldier's problem. For most, the intelligence side of the war was to them a black box. They saw themselves as shooters. Anything that distracted them from their priorities of fixing and finishing was a waste. This was what the awesome machine had taught them to do. They prepared to strike a new target. Meanwhile, screening and exploitation of the files found at the car dealer's house began. New grist for the awesome machine. But the car dealer's name was imprecisely recorded, a common occurrence among Westerners dealing with unfamiliar naming conventions. And though the intelligence gathered had the potential to identify follow-up AQI targets, by the time it had navigated the labyrinth of security clearances and made its way back to our task force, 4 days had passed. The car dealer's network had vanished. When AQI operatives were captured, the network quickly ensured that everyone connected to the target would disappear. Our information had become useless. Our operation was a success at the level of each individual team, but it was also rife with opportunities left unrealized for our task force at large. This was the frustration of operating a command of teams where information wasn't clearly shared. At its heart, F3EA was a rational, reductionist process. It took a complex set of tasks, broke them down, and distributed them to the specialized individuals or teams best suited to accomplish them. When we started falling behind in the fight against AQI, we tried to do what we had always done, only better. Meticulously construct schedules, increase our intelligence structure, add interrogators, analysts, and technicians by the score, and sharpen our focus. If we each did our tasks better than ever, we thought, our machine would be unstoppable. We came from a background where if you were losing, you just weren't trying hard enough, recalls a SEAL commander who operated in Baghdad. So we started going all out, timing how long it took us from the moment we fixed a target to get out of our cots, get our gear on, load choppers. F3EA got tighter, faster, and more focused. By August 2004, we were running 18 raids a month, a higher pace than we had thought possible. But it wasn't enough. By focusing on the component parts rather than the overall process, we were missing the fundamental problem. Speeding up the individual elements of the system did nothing to eliminate the blinks between them that most stymied our efforts. There were geographical blinks and technological ones. The distance between Washington and Baghdad could slow decisions, and occasionally bandwidth problems obstructed the transfer of data. More often, though, the blinks were social. Cultural differences between the task force's different tribes got in the way of communicating. Overcoming this would require completely rethinking the conventional organizational approach to distributing information. The need-to-know fallacy. Any aficionado of action movies has heard the line, "That's on a need-to-know basis, and you don't need to know," uttered by a broad-shouldered, square-jawed caricature of a special operations commando or serious-faced intelligence agent. Though we rarely use that phrase in real life, it is an accurate depiction of military and broader organizational sentiments about the value of information. Given the overwhelming volume of and myriad sensitivities around information, the default is not to share. As the different components of the F3EA process were executed, each team tended to view its role in splendid isolation. Their ability to specialize in their own domains necessitated ignorance of the process at large. For operators, time spent learning about the black box of intelligence was a distraction that took them away from their proper duties. But this limited definition of efficiency meant that they passed on information that was often less useful than it should have been, late, or lacking context. Had each of our teams been an individual at BUDS, he would have gotten booted in week one. They took pride in their own team's performance, like the prima donna slugger who touts his high batting average as his team consistently loses. Instinctively, the silos of our organization looked inward, where they could see metrics of success and failure. The habit of constraining information derives in part from modern security concerns, but also from the inured preference for clearly defined mechanistic processes, whether factory floors or corporate org charts, in which people need to know only their own piece of the puzzle to do their job. One of the oldest and most famous examples of specialization and the compartmentalized ignorance that such specialization encourages can be found in Adam Smith's 1776 description of a pin factory in his classic work, The Wealth of Nations. One man draws out the wire, another straights it, a third cuts it, a fourth points it, a fifth grinds it at the top for receiving the head. The important business of making a pin is, in this manner, divided into about 18 distinct operations. I have seen a small manufactory of this kind where 10 men only were employed, and those 10 persons could make among them upwards of 48,000 pins in a day. But if they had all wrought separately and independently, and without any of them having been educated to this peculiar business, they certainly could not each of them have made 20, perhaps not one, pin in a day. That is, certainly, not the 240th, perhaps not the 4,800th part of what they are at present capable of performing, in consequence of a proper division and combination of their different operations. The pin factory benefits from putting blinders on each individual worker, as have many operations since. A man moving pig iron did not need to know where that iron came from before it arrived at the factory, or what the man who received it after him did with it. The assembly line worker building his small portion of a ship did not need to understand how the final product came together. But come together it would, thanks to the aggregation of these discrete efforts and the intricate designs of managers. Things in comforting simplicity were the sum of their parts. The economic success of reductionist efficiencies in the 20th century inspired increasingly fundamentalist adherence to Smith's doctrine of specialization. But as technology has grown more sophisticated and processes more dispersed, the way component parts of a process come together has become far less intuitive, and in many cases impossible for a cadre of managers to predict fully. In a pin factory, a holistic understanding of the product is self-evident. Making pins is simple, and a worker in Smith's manufactory could easily see how his labor interacted with that of his peers. Even if each worker performed only one task, he still understood, at least in some way, the entire pin-making process and could probably explain the tasks of his fellow workers. Such is no longer the case in many factories. As technology has grown more sophisticated and processes more dispersed, the way component parts of a process come together has become far less intuitive. The man who fixes a valve on the landing gear of a passenger jet probably can't explain the details of the complete jet assembly. Taylor saved money by firing the paper pulp chemist and replacing him with an uneducated laborer and a chart. Time and money spent learning the whole process would be time away from the job and money not spent on supplies. In the short run, this kind of education may not seem worth the opportunity cost. In military, governmental, and corporate sectors, an increased concern for secrecy has caused further sequestering of information. We have secrets, and secrets need to be guarded. In the wrong hands, information may do great damage, as the recent Snowden and WikiLeaks scandals have shown. In the absence of a compelling reason to do otherwise, it makes sense to confine information by the borders of its relevance. As growing volumes of data flood institutions divided into increasingly specialized departments, the systems for keeping information safe have become more and more complicated. More protocols have to be satisfied, more tests have to be conducted, more badges have to be swiped before information can be shared. Over the decades, America's military and intelligence institutions have developed intricate matrices of clearances and silos to ensure that, as a Hollywood general might put it, people don't know what they don't need to know. In early 2003, when I served as the Vice Director for Operations on the Pentagon's Joint Staff, the United States Central Command, CENTCOM, initially prohibited the Pentagon staffs from viewing their internal website out of a common fear of giving higher headquarters visibility into unfinalized planning products. Such absurdities reflect the truth that most organizations are more concerned with how best to control information than how best to share it. CENTCOM is the combatant command responsible for the geographic theater of the Middle East, North Africa, and Central Asia. At this time, notably, this included preparation for the then upcoming Iraq War. The problem is that the logic of need to know depends on the assumption that somebody, some manager or algorithm or bureaucracy, actually knows who does and does not need to know which material. In order to say definitively that a SEAL ground force does not need awareness of a particular intelligence source, or that an intel analyst does not need to know precisely what happened on any given mission, the commander must be able to say with confidence that those pieces of knowledge have no bearing on what those teams are attempting to do, nor on the situations the analyst may encounter. Our experience showed us this was never the case. More than once in Iraq, we were close to mounting capture-kill operations, only to learn at the last hour that the targets were working undercover for another coalition entity. The organizational structures we had developed in the name of secrecy and efficiency actively prevented us from talking to each other and assembling a full picture. Effective prediction, as we have discussed, has become increasingly difficult, and in many situations, impossible. Continuing to function under the illusion that we can understand and foresee exactly what will be relevant to whom is hubris. It might feel safe, but it is the opposite. Functioning safely in an interdependent environment requires that every team possess a holistic understanding of the interaction between all the moving parts. Everyone has to see the system in its entirety for the plan to work. A fable. The failure of the Krasnovian soccer team. Let's imagine that our fictional war game adversary, Krasnovia, liked the mechanical era too much to leave it. We can envision it as a country of Rube Goldberg-like contraptions, engineered to do everything from getting people dressed in the morning to ironing their evening papers. The country's president, recently elected to his seventh term with 97% of the popular vote, does not believe in complexity. The economy is centrally planned, down to every family's daily food choices. Even the ecosystem is regulated. Instead of exposing the state to the non-linearity of evolution, government scientists laboring in concrete towers have devised schedules for breeding and then releasing neutered animals into the wild. Starlings in April, toads in September. Like his president, the coach of the Krasnovian soccer team, Coach T, worships at the altar of determinism, and on graduating from the National Academy of Planning, he resolves to bring reductionist management to the world's greatest game. Coach T's players don't know one another's names. They've never even seen each other. The men train separately in one-on-one sessions with their coach. In these daily meetings, Coach T has his players focus on honing their personal fitness and rehearsing their respective portions of the 712 plays that he has designed. Once a year, the team assembles to rehearse. For these occasions, Coach T has developed an ingenious, lightweight piece of headgear similar to the blinders worn by horses. The contraption is designed to minimize distraction. When wearing it, players see only their individual patch of grass. Many of them, raised from a young age in one of the dedicated soccer camps developed by Coach T for each individual position, have never seen the entire field. The annual practice is a beautiful thing to watch. The players' physical condition is unrivaled. They execute their plays flawlessly. Their arch-rival, Atropia, is nowhere near as fit, fast, or disciplined, and every 4 years, when the teams meet in the qualifying rounds of the World Cup, Krasnovian hopes run high. Usually, around minute 5, however, something happens that diverges from any of Coach T's 712 plans. The Krasnovians continue to execute their immaculate choreography, but they are kicking at the air and passing to nobody. The Atropians, without a plan but with awareness of the entire field, run circles around them. After each loss, Coach T goes back and devises another plan. And by the next match, he has a flawless solution to the expired Atropian plays. Contemporary environments now present too many equivalent likelihoods for top-down Krasnovian planning. Errors like misrecording a name could easily be corrected with some training and a memorandum, but that would do nothing to prevent the thousands of other tiny deviations, any one of which might also generate outsized impacts. Like the landing gear failure that ultimately doomed United 173, the root cause lay not in the lack of a specific procedure, but in the inability to correct, in real time, in response to unexpected inconsistencies. Task force leadership was playing whack-a-mole. We could pick off problems as they arose, but we would never be able to predict and prescribe exactly what analysis would be relevant to specific operational teams or what types of materials our operators should seek to help our analysts. In situations of unpredictability, organizations need to improvise. And, to do that, the players on the field need to understand the broader context. At the team level, this is self-evident. But at the broader institutional level, it is more difficult to engineer structures that are both coherent and improvisatory. The problem at one level was obvious. We were failing to create useful bonds between one team and the next. The work done by our operators and analysts was inextricably linked, and yet we had placed the two groups in separate organizational silos. We had given them blinders, in the name of efficiency. Our players could only see the ball once it entered their immediate territory, by which time it would likely be too late to react. With no knowledge of the constantly shifting perspective of their teammates, they would have no idea what to do with the ball once they got it. They were playing Krasnovian soccer, Though our task force had never found itself in this quandary before, neither the challenge nor the eventual solution was new. New metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented. In September 1962, at Rice University, an enthusiastic President Kennedy, shining with sweat, delivered a now famous speech. He pledged that the United States would send humans 240,000 miles away from the control station in Houston in a giant rocket more than 300 feet tall, made of new metal alloys, some of which have not yet been invented, capable of standing heat and stresses several times more than have ever been experienced, fitted together with a precision better than the finest watch, carrying all the equipment needed for propulsion, guidance, control, communications, food, and survival on an uncharted mission to an unknown celestial body, and then return it safely to Earth, re-entering the atmosphere at speeds of over 25,000 miles per hour, causing heat about half that of the temperature of the sun, and do all this, and do it right, and do it first, before this decade is out. We must be bold. As we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked. Kennedy enumerated the obstacles, the distance, speed, and heat, not to dissuade, but to inspire. One can imagine the thrill that must have pulsed through the audience of budding engineers as their president pointed out that the metals necessary to achieve this feat had not yet been invented. Earlier in the speech, Kennedy uttered the memorable statement, "We do these things not because they are easy, but because they are hard." Less than 7 years later, more than 600 million viewers around the world tuned in to watch Neil Armstrong set foot on lunar soil and proclaim one giant leap for mankind before planting an American flag on the moon. To the best of our knowledge, that flag, though toppled by the lander's liftoff blast and likely bleached white from decades of unfiltered sunlight, is still there. The ridged imprints from Armstrong's rubber soles, tiny, perfectly geometric mountain ranges, still stand, preserved in the windless stasis of our favorite celestial boulder. No matter what happens on frenzied Earth, the traces of Apollo 11 should serve as a testament to human ingenuity for millions of years. Almost as significant as what happened in space exploration in July 1969, however, is what did not happen. 2 weeks before the Apollo 11 launch, on the other side of the Atlantic, the F-8 rocket assembled by ELDO, the European Launcher Development Organization, failed on the launch pad. It was ELDO's fifth consecutive total failure. NASA and ELDO had similar ambitions and faced the same challenges. The success of one and the failure of the other had little to do with differences in expertise or resources, and much to do with how the organizations distributed information. NASA was, thanks to an approach known as systems management, a more effective organization. NASA administrators Robert Siemens and Frederick Ordway summarized the nature of their achievement as follows. The Apollo project is generally considered as one of the greatest technological endeavors in the history of mankind, but in order to achieve this, a managerial effort no less prodigious than the technological one was required. In the years leading up to Kennedy's speech, the United States had lagged embarrassingly in the space race. The Soviet Union had produced the first Earth orbiter, the first animal in orbit, the first lunar flyby, the first lunar impact, and the first images of the far side of the moon. It would soon put Yuri Gagarin into orbit, the first man in space. In the meantime, the American space effort struggled. NASA's first unmanned test flight, Mercury Redstone 1, lifted off on November 21, 1960, but it did not lift very far. The launcher rose 4 inches off the ground, then settled back down.